This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Monday when much of the Northeast is spreading salt, getting ready to shovel snow and making sure the cupboard is ready for a few days of blizzard. For those of you listening where the skies are sunny and warm, we want you to know that we're not going to adopt some myopic weather obsession and blizzard you with endless winter happens in January headlines. No, no. We hope you'll stay tuned to this station or wherever your local sources of information are for the latest on angry Mother Nature. But we're going to start this program with a broader conversation that takes in many of the recent disturbing headlines on protests and racial tension, police shootings and brutality, law enforcement strategy, and the very positive overall national trend of declining crime rates. The incidence of serious crime has been cut in half since 1993. The social science behind the law enforcement strategy of leaving the focus on kingpins alone and making small crimes the priority has been called the broken windows theory. One unrepaired broken window is a signal that no one cares, and so breaking more windows costs nothing. That was written in an influential article in The Atlantic magazine back in the 1980s. The authors, the late social scientist James Q. Wilson of Harvard and social scientist George Kelling. Kelling has watched the controversy over broken windows grow, and the intent of broken windows, he says, distorted in cases of unarmed defendants dying in police custody, the racial tension in communities alienated from law enforcement, and policies like stop and frisk that have been also questioned by the courts. Kelling defends his theory but says there is so much more to consider in the actual practice of law enforcement. The cops, he says, need to be a part of the community they are policing.
Our belief from the beginning was that order was an important part of any civilized society, that if you're going to have strong education, strong faith institutions, strong commerce, you have to have minimal levels of order. And we believed that order was an end in itself. But we also knew the research, disorder, was strongly linked to fear of crime. We had known that since the 1960s, but criminologists hadn't paid much attention to it. What was the outreach of the article was that we speculated that it might have something to do with serious crime as well. That, of course, has become the most controversial area of broken windows. But it started with this idea that any civilized society has to have minimal levels of order. Strangers have to feel comfortable for a city to really thrive.
Did you think back in those days with James Wilson that there were upper limits on the extent to which you could take this broken windows policy to an extreme and it would produce negative consequences in law enforcement?
Oh, I think we were fearful of that from the very beginning. The use of loitering laws and vagrancy laws to arrest people is a very sad history. It was used during the in the post-Civil War period into the 20th century to keep many African Americans in virtual slavery, so that we understood it had enormous potential for abuse. And if you reread the article, we fuss and stew about the issues of justice and equity considerably during that article. Understand that at that point, the idea of broken windows was being developed, but broken windows policing was still something to be considered and something to be developed. And so we were raising these issues out of concern that as broken windows ideas worked their way into policy, it had to be done with considerable concern for how discretion was used, that it was used appropriately. I think we suspected even then it was a powerful tool, like many other powerful tools, that had a large or had a capacity for abuse and misuse as well.
The decline in crime in the 90s and the early part of this century certainly made the community policing broken windows techniques seem as though they were a real magic bullet. Do you think that the success or perceived success of broken windows allowed a policy like stop and frisk to be almost unquestioningly adopted when at other times in American history it might have been viewed with a little more skepticism?
I think that's entirely possible, and I think that many people equate stop, question, and frisk and broken windows, and they really are quite distinct. Stop, question, and frisk is based upon suspicion. I think the problem that developed within broken windows is arrest became the goal of broken windows, and that is to arrest people who were committing minor offenses. From the very beginning of its implementation, our goal was not to arrest people. We warned people, first of all, broadly, on such and such a date, we're going to be cracking down on fare beating in the subway. Stop doing it now. The whole idea was to persuade people to behave in appropriate ways and no longer jump over the toll booths. Well, those that persisted, of course, might ultimately wind up being arrested. But even then, we sent out booking buses so that we would interfere with people's lives for as short a period of time as we possibly could. So the idea that it's focused on getting arrests is really a serious misconception.
What's your answer to the charge that broken windows was not based on data, that it was based more on an impression of two social scientists?
Oh, I think we were clear at the beginning that it was a speculation. I don't think it's a speculation anymore. Right now, my own feeling is that the burden of proof is no longer on those who advocate broken windows. The burden of proof is on those who suggest that it doesn't have any impact on crime. But I want to add something, and that is it's easy also to oversell the impact that broken windows had on serious crime. New York City's the classic example. There were all kinds of targeted anti-crime efforts, hotspot policing, and as time went on, other tactics that developed that had nothing to do with broken windows.
So let's talk about this idea of reducing the fear of crime, which was the original mission of broken windows on some level. As a social scientist, how do you trade off the reassurance that one sector of society feels by crime going down with the apparent increase of fear of law enforcement that goes up because the people who are targeted in some of these policies feel as though law enforcement is really focusing on them inappropriately?
It's a sad commentary that it's come to this because we've made so much progress. When I first start considering how neighborhoods ought to be policed, the first thing that I count is victimization, and that is who's suffering the most. And almost regardless of where you go in the United States, whether you're talking about New York or whether you're talking about Seattle, one finds that it's the poor and the minorities who are most suffering from crime and disorder and demanding that something be done, because the demand for order in minority communities is very, very strong. We should have done a better job, however, in making sure we did this in ways that were congruent with community policing. And that is, for me, broken windows has always been subsumed or is a tactic under community policing. And if you move away from community policing, I think you're moving away from the genius of Anglo-Saxon policing. And that is that police operate on behalf of citizens, they have to work with citizens, and they ought to determine the priorities working with citizens and the standards of neighborhoods within the law working with citizens. And if you forget that, there is a point at which you can begin to question, is the cost of reducing crime in terms of developing antagonism so great that we're not going to push this hard? Minority communities have a history of two problems with the police. One is police brutality. That's a serious problem. It has to be dealt with. But the second is under-policing, and that is the kind of attitude of the past, oh, that's how these people are, and there's no sense in trying to police that neighborhood. So we have to worry about both problems. And my fear is, because of the questions that are being raised now about police overuse of authority, we're going to under-police minority communities again, and that's at great, great cost.
George Kelling is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, one of the co-authors of the so-called broken windows theory, first published in an article in The Atlantic he co-wrote with the late James Wilson. George, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
During the course of an extended conversation with George Kelling, he disclosed that he has been consulting with the NYPD on the case of Eric Garner, who died during an attempted arrest. He couldn't comment specifically on the Garner case, but he did say focusing on small crimes entails some large risks that increase when police and citizens don't agree on what is a small crime, i.e., what is a broken window.
Politicians and leaders of communities have to make up their minds about what they want enforced and what they don't want enforced. If you're going to enforce these kinds of ordinances and you have a lot of contacts, it is inevitable that occasionally some of those contacts are going to go awry. There is an inevitability. It might be the behavior of the person who's committing the offense. It might be the incompetence of the officer. It might be a mistake of the officer. But when you have the law in the books and demand from neighborhoods to do something about these things, the police simply can't stand back and do nothing. And so a tragedy is going to occur sometime.
More on police strategy and the challenge of being a part of the community later this week. We always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share the good and the bad of the police in your community.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
A consumer beware story now out in California. How a mom had to become an investigator to find out the track record of the daycare center she was considering for her own child. The mom, fortunately, was an investigator already. Catherine Miskowski is a senior reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She discovered that parents already in emotional turmoil over the decision to choose daycare are faced with a very difficult slog to discover the truth about facilities that are supposed to be regulated.
In California, you're supposed to either ask the child care provider for the records, which can be kind of dicey. Like, if they have a lot of problems, are they really going to show you this stack of records? Or alternatively, you're supposed to call an obscure government office, if you happen to know it exists, and leave a message, and you can get a sense of what it sounds like when you call one of these places.
First, leave your name and the age of the child for whom your care will be provided. Second, leave your telephone number. Third, the facility number. Fourth, the name of the child care center, or in case of a family daycare provider, the name of the person giving the care. Fifth, the street address and city.
Now, that actually wasn't the voice of Franz Kafka, but I can't imagine that was particularly reassuring, although we should stipulate. I mean, they're trying to help here. What was your experience?
Well, my experience was I was scrambling looking for childcare because my daughter's preschool had shut down abruptly. I found that number. I called it. I left all the information they asked for, and no one ever called me back.
So how does that experience get replicated in the people that you investigated?
I started looking into this at work, and I found that there were some daycares in California that had dozens of serious violations. And then I wondered, did parents who had children going to those programs know about these violations? So I started trying to talk to those parents, and I found one family on Yelp through a scathing Yelp review they had written.
Right off the bat, I say avoid this place. Then it says, if you do not care about how your child gets treated, then by all means, do sign up with the school.
And this is the voice of Mazen Bayoun giving a pretty bad review of the Sierra School.
So I went and met with Mazen and his wife, Holly, and I talked to them about their experience with this school. Their daughter had only gone there for a few weeks, really, and she got a pretty serious injury. She had a black eye, which months later still hadn't healed. The school told them that she had had an accident on the playground. Their daughter said that a teacher had hit her, and the sheriff's office actually investigated, and there were no charges filed, but the parents were very upset, and they removed their child from the school. And I wanted to know, did these parents know when they sent their child to the school that it had all these violations and it actually was on probation? The state had been so concerned about what was going on there that it had threatened to take its license, and a judge had put the school on a 3-year probation. As part of the probation, the judge had said that the child care center had to show the parents information about the fact that it was on probation. So they should have known when they sent their child there that it had a lot of problems.
So who's responsible here? I mean, obviously the facility is responsible if anybody is hurt in the course of their care, but how much of this is a parents beware story?
Well, the director of the school is responsible for showing these records to the parents. But what we found in this case is that, you know, they hadn't seen them. And when we interviewed the director of the school, she said that, oh, yes, all the parents at the school are informed as they are supposed to be under state law. And then she even produced documents that parents had signed, you know, saying that they knew this information. But one of the documents she produced was from this family, the Bayouns, and it was dated almost 2 months after their child no longer was attending the school. So, you know, we came to believe, and Mazin told us that he thought this document was forged, and we tried to confront the director of the school about that, but at that point she was no longer talking to us. But the larger point here is, can the state really trust schools that have problems to inform parents that these problems are going on? And I think what we see in this case is that they can't, and that it's incumbent upon the state to make this information widely available to parents online, so in a few clicks, you know, you can find out what's really happening.
Is the state of California making changes?
They have made some. After our initial reporting, lawmakers passed a bill that forces them to put some very basic information about inspections online. But even that won't tell you what violations an individual school got. So you could find out that they had some problems, but you won't be able to find out what they actually were. Since it varies a lot from state to state, we put together a map on our website, revealnews.org, where parents can look up and find out, does their state put these records online? If so, there's a link to those records. If not, there's a link to the department that does the regulation, so they can try to get a hold of this information there.
And without being too judgmental here, is there a state that you would say is closer to the model of how things should go than California?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's 29 states that put this information online, including Texas and Indiana, and there's just a lot more transparency. I will say that the federal government is trying to get states to be more transparent. Last November, a law was passed that Obama signed that basically says if you want to keep getting federal child care subsidies, you have to be more transparent with parents. So there is some hope that in states that are lagging behind, like California, the situation will improve.
Catherine Miskowski is a senior reporter for the news service Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting in California. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Another ISIS video beheading over the weekend. We observed the tragic outrage for people in Japan hoping to save a second Japanese hostage, and the disgust of the world over ISIS once again. But that disgust is not matched by the global fear of the terrorist organization we saw for most of last year. Under continuing U.S. and allied airstrikes, Iraqi and Kurdish opposition troops have been emboldened to push back ISIS on the ground in Syria. Reports from Beirut say ISIS forces have been nearly pushed out of the Syrian border town of Kobani. It suggests that perhaps ISIS is having the same kind of trouble that former Secretary of State Colin Powell warned of a long time ago before the U.S. invasion of Iraq when he invoked the so-called Pottery Barn Rule.
Once you break it, you're going to own it, and we're going to be responsible for 26 million people standing there looking at us. And it's going to suck up a good 40 to 50% of your army for years, and it's going to take all the oxygen out of the political environment. And you need to understand this, and the expense is going to be enormous.
Is ISIS having trouble maintaining tactical momentum amidst its continuing show of brutality? Joining us now is Martin Reardon, FBI veteran and an analyst and senior vice president with the strategic consultants, the Sufan Group. Martin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here.
So what would you say is a snapshot right now of ISIS, given what's going on with the hostages in Japan and what appears to be something of a pushback, if not rollback, on the ground in Syrian territory?
ISIS is still a formidable force. And I think the initial goal of the coalition airstrikes that started back in the fall have been successful to date. And the primary was initially to stop their advance in Iraq. And I think they have succeeded in doing that. But you're not going to defeat ISIS from the air. And the administration has said that all along. We're not going to measure this in terms of months. We're going to measure this fight in terms of years. Now, they've stopped the advance on the ground in Iraq with the airstrikes. It'll be a few months down the road before the Iraqis are actually ready to start a ground offensive to retake Mosul. And that's going to be a hard-fought battle.
Holding Mosul as a symbolic gesture is one thing, but thinking more broadly about the territory ISIS has tried to hold for the last, half year or more, is there a bit of the argument that Colin Powell made about Iraq that if you break it, you own it? And in a sense, ISIS is dealing with some of the complex problems of actually governing and holding territory right now. And aside from holding Mosul, they're looking pretty desperate.
I would not say that they're looking desperate. I mean, and again, it is a large chunk of Iraq and Syria that they're trying to maintain control of. And that's the phase they're in, is they took the territory. Now it's maintained the control. The U.S. military, the Allied forces, had this same problem in Iraq the whole time in the early 2000s when they were there, maintaining control of this area.
And maybe desperate is overplaying the argument here, but I'm just wondering if you do compare with the chaos that the U.S. Found in Iraq, isn't this at least a distraction for ISIS? ISIS has limited capability to launch attacks against the United States when they're held down in this territory in such a chaotic situation right now. Maybe it's not desperate, but it's certainly distracted.
ISIS does not have to conduct attacks against the United States, either on U.S. facilities or Western areas outside the U.S. or on the homeland itself. All they have to do is inspire somebody in the United States or where those U.S. Foreign facilities are to conduct attack, and they have been successful in that.
And let's talk about the hostage situation with the Japanese. I mean, I think we're all disgusted once again and horrified with video executions and the demands for ransom. Yet as this proceeds, the ability that ISIS has to hold the attention of the world, it seems to me, diminishes, as tragic as the situation in Japan is.
Well, I think, and this is tragic, the most recent hostage situation with Haruna Yakawa and Kenji Goto. It is tragic. And I think in one respect, the public is being desensitized to this. I mean, it was headline news. It's still headline news, but it was much more of a headline news back in August and September. This has happened a number of times now. People are almost expecting it. And when you're talking about hostages, they're expecting that's what's going to happen, unfortunately. This is an interesting, this most recent hostage-taking situation is a little bit interesting, because while ISIS started off with the $200 million demand for ransom, and that figure was based on what the prime minister of Japan had promised to give the coalition forces, they've since changed that to they would exchange Mr. Goto for Shajida al-Rashawi, who is in Jordanian custody right now. She's affiliated with al-Qaeda, not with ISIS.
But, you know, not to be argumentative, that just feels like they've overplayed their hand over there. And, you know, there's a strategic question of how is this going to inspire people around the world to join the mission if the ability of ISIS to hold the attention of the world is diminishing?
Now, they're still holding the attention. I'm just saying I think these hostage situations aren't quite the headline that they were. And quite frankly, the interest in the nightly news on airstrikes isn't the same interest as when it first started. Wars are like that. The interest draws off. ISIS is still there. And their ideology, that violent form of jihadism, now oftentimes referred to as bin Ladenism, that's still there. And they do inspire people of similar ideology around the world. I mean, for every ISIS fighter that is killed, there are a number of more who continue to fill their ranks. So that, you know, and ISIS in Iraq, there's a very strong possibility that the Iraqi army is going to retake Mosul the first time that they attempt it. And then ISIS as a major force would be pushed out of Iraq. But there is nobody to oppose ISIS in Syria right now except the Assad regime. The rebels have had virtually no success on it, al-Nusra to an extent. So getting ISIS out of Iraq is one thing. Defeating them in Syria is an entirely different story.
Martin Reardon is senior vice president with the Soufan Group, a New York-based strategic security intelligence consultancy. He's also a 21-year veteran at the FBI. Thanks so much, Martin.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
We're going to conclude this hour with some thoughts on how the global phenomenon of radicalization and terrorism may be more relevant to the kinds of community policing ideas we were talking about earlier. If the radicalization of young men is perceived less as a mobilized global army and movement and more as a reaction to hopelessness in communities around the world where there are no opportunities, think less about the kingpins like Osama bin Laden and more about the nameless young men who join groups like ISIS. From the terrorist attacks in Paris to the recruits who join ISIS that we know nothing about, can it be addressed by viewing it as a social pathology, curing radicalization on the ground where it finds sympathy rather than fighting battles exclusively in Syria or in airports or on the streets of Paris? Scott Atran has observed a pattern in extensive field interviews with would-be and convicted terrorists. He is a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and an anthropologist at the University of Michigan. Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
What do you think the principal sort of value is in thinking about terrorism from the perspective of psychological, individual sort of deterioration or radicalization?
Well, it's a convergence of a number of things. I mean, mostly it's young people in transitional stages in their lives between 18 on up to 30, between jobs, between girlfriends, immigrant students, having left their native family, looking for a new family, and especially those on the margins, much more so, of course, in Europe than here, where Muslims, for example, they integrate and become get average socioeconomic status and education by the first generation. In Europe, even after three generations, they're 10 times more likely to be poor and less educated. They live in housing projects. France, for example, about 7.5 million people, 7.5%, excuse me. Yet it's 60 to 75% of the prison population, very much like black youth in ghettos in the United States. But the difference is there's an ideology out there. So for, you know, one guy I was interviewing wanted to blow up the American embassy, and I asked him, well, why did you want to do that? And he gave me the whole spiel about oppression of Muslims across the world. And I said, no, why'd you want to do it? And he said, well, you know, I was walking down the street, Boulevard La République. My sister was window shopping. She had a veil on. She bumped into this elderly French man, and he spat at her and said, Sale Arab, you dirty Arab. And he said, then I knew I wanted to join the jihad. But I said, there's always been racism out there. He said, yes, but the jihad didn't exist. It's an attractor. It doesn't recruit. People are self-seekers, and it's a very, very powerful ideology. We think it's crazy, but the caliphate, it's here to stay as an idea, and is drawing more and more people. So I wouldn't even call it terrorism anymore. It's a worldwide, global, world historical movement, and it's becoming very dangerous.
Is it a movement in the sense of a political movement that is organized, or is it simply the disgruntlement and hopelessness of a large demographic that may or may not be interrelated?
Well, certainly appealing to the hopelessness of that large demographic. That's its pool of volunteers. But the movement itself is a very, very deeply moral and ideological movement.
So if this were a strategy of law enforcement, say on the street, and you have young, disgruntled kids in the United States – falling in love with the adventure of being a, you know, sort of drug kingpin or something like that. The police strategy or the social strategy would be to get them other heroes, sports figures, role models, that sort of thing. First of all, did that work in the United States? And is there a model for dealing with crime of terrorism that puts it in a law enforcement model rather than this like fight ISIS to the death model?
Right. Well, the United States is very different, of course. And the NYPD, despite what people say about it, has done a marvelous job at being able to handle it. They realize, like jihadis all over the world, I mean potential jihadis, that 3 out of every 4 of people join it through their friends, about 20% through their families. There's very little recruitment. And when you have local policing, like the NYPD is, when you're in the neighborhoods with people from the same ethnic group in the police department talking to these people, saying, look, we don't want a problem. You don't want a problem. Let's work together. It can work. But in Europe, it's very different. These people are on the margins. They live in these unbelievable housing projects where people don't even dare to go. There's really no hope there. And when people get out of prison, there's a huge echo in the community to keep it going.
So Europe particularly, thinking of the Charlie Hebdo attacks of this month, should look to itself and the way it's socially organized, not look to some battle in Syria or Iraq as a way of stopping the terrorist attacks that were so demoralizing to the people of France.
Yeah, American social fabric is built to assimilate immigrants, whatever the foreign policy is and whatever the current debate is on immigration. It's still built to assimilate that. It never was in Europe. This is a new thing in Europe. They don't know how to handle it. And then they make sort of ridiculous statements like it has nothing at all to do with Islam, which is crazy too. But you can't, you know, you can't put it on the Islamic community, but you've got to deal with the fact that these people have not been integrated in society, and you've got to try to come up with solutions that come from within them.
All right, in your experience, and you've spent a lot of time on the ground here, what you're saying is pretty important. It seems to me that in Europe, you're saying that a young, hopeless, you know, jihad-inspired young person, when they get the sense of the movement, don't really have an option to do something on the ground in France that might better their own life. But in the United States, anybody who maybe is attracted by jihadism also knows that they have a shot at some kind of entrepreneurial on the ground, even just a stupid small business. But they have way more of an option in the United States because we're an assimilated economy than they do in Europe.
Yeah, they do. I mean, one of the terrible things about Europe itself is that the young people completely feel totally on the outs and have no idea what to do.
It sounds like the better defense against domestic terrorism in the United States is this assimilation culture, not our law enforcement and Homeland Security. Is that what you observed?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, another real big problem there that's not here is the ideals of liberal democracy, the things that made the American Revolution and even the French Revolution, they're not inspiring young people anymore to sacrifices. If you look at the recent polls, an ICM poll from this summer, one out of every four French young people between the ages of 24, not just Muslims, which are only 7-8% of the population, all French young people find the Islamic State attractive. On the other side, you've got the radical right, the xenophobic nationalists playing into it, and you have this tacit alliance between the radical Islam and the xenophobic rights that's tearing apart European society like the fascists and the communists did in the 1920s. And the middle class is being torn apart in Europe. They don't really know what to do. And The divide is increasing, and I'm not all that optimistic.
Scott Atran is a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Also, he's an anthropologist at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Real simple, folks. Balls deflate, abdomens inflate. It's Super Bowl week, and while sports fans are going to argue about the pounds per square inch in New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's football, we're starting a much bigger argument over what kind of dip should you have available for family and friends during the endless Super Bowl game itself. Dan Pashman, host of WNYC's Sporkful podcast and author of Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. We've got a daily dip for each day leading up to the game. And the genre Dan attacks today are those parfait-looking creations that just sit there waiting to be attacked by hungry chip and veggie-armed eaters. Dan, genre number one.
Multi-layer dips. When you're talking about a multi-layer dip, I think there's two questions you really got to consider. The first is, how many layers is too many? Now, if your goal is to take a picture of your dip and post it on the internet and get as many clicks for your blog as possible, then there's no such thing as too many. But if your goal is deliciousness, try to exercise some restraint. So let's talk about a multi-layer dip that I get really excited about. And for me, it's taco dip. I love a good taco dip. But I think that restraint needs to be exercised. I love a classic three-layer taco dip, nice and hot. You make your taco meat, or it could be veggies, tofu, whatever you want. Season it with your taco seasoning, the ground meat, ground veggies. That's your first layer. Then a layer of sour cream and a layer of cheddar cheese. Put it in the oven till the cheese is nice and melty, and you're good to go. Now, I know that some taco dips have more layers, and that's okay to a point, but I want to encourage you to avoid shredded lettuce. It's the bane of my existence, okay? It has too high of a surface area to volume ratio, and it's exposed to the salt and fat of the dip. it releases water. And waters down the flavor of your dip. It's not a good thing. You don't want shredded lettuce in your taco dip. Please, I'm asking you, please, don't do it. So you've got this beautiful taco dip I've created for you with hot melted cheese on top. And the chip you're going to need for today's daily dip is the classic old-fashioned triangular tortilla chip. Hold it by one of the straight edges so you can lead with one sharp point of that triangle. That's how you pierce the various layers of a multi-layer dip for maximum deliciousness.
So daily dip one, taco. Dan Pashman will be back tomorrow with another suggestion for your Super Bowl party. If you want to share your favorite dip with us, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And if you want to see Dan's taco dip, you can find the recipe on our site, thetakeaway.org.
Now dip it into sauce. You scoop it up. Dip back again. Chips forward. Bread ahead. Try to ingest it. It's not too late to dip it. Dip it good.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.